You are listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Many of the brightest minds in biomedical research and clinical care have extracurricular talents. At Stanford Medicine, you'll find painters, sculptors, musicians, writers, singers, and magicians, or at least one magician, Parag Mallick. When he's not developing computer models to improve cancer detection, Mallick is juggling fire, walking on stilts, or mastering card tricks. Today we'll talk with Parag Mallick about how he became a member of a professional performance troupe and the relationship between science and magic. He's an assistant professor of radiology and a member of the Canary Center at Stanford for Cancer Early Detection. Parag Mallick, thank you for joining me on One to One. So a magician and a data scientist. Connect those dots for me. Put those together. How did the magician part come about, and how did the research scientist come about, and how are they connected?
Well, they grew up completely independently of each other. As a kid, I dorked around with magic, like many people do. I wasn't very serious about it. Then I went on with my life not being a magician. In college, I became a juggler, which, as it turns out, is a slippery slope dragging you down into the rest of circus arts. Mm. And so I became much more involved in the circus, took formal training. And then during graduate school, I got back to magic. I started taking classes at the Magic Castle in Hollywood, right. Took on a mentor, and it really evolved in parallel.
So people may not know what the Magic Castle is, and it's this, if you're in magic, it is this incredible spot, restaurant, yeah, in the middle of Los Angeles.
Yeah, so the Magic Castle is a really special place. There are really only, there's it and the Magic Circle in England that are incredibly unique. It's a private club for magicians. You have to audition to become a member. And demonstrate that you are, in fact, a competent magician. And then every night they have seven different shows that are, in order to get in, you get an invitation from a member or you join a member. And it's a tremendous privilege to perform there. Amazing magic. They also have a library filled with books and pamphlets, books that are signed by Houdini. It's a truly remarkable place.
Now, you said that you were classically trained, I'll use the phrase, in circus arts. Yeah. Talk about that. Why did you choose to – did you at some point think that that was going to be your path?
No. I always liked doing both. So it actually turns out that that circus arts and juggling in particular is very meditative. And also many mathematicians are drawn to juggling.
Why is that? Explain that, you know, when I was reading background about you, you often spoke about mathematics and why math is important to magic.
Yeah. So math is really important to magic and a lot of the circus arts, in part because through the connection of music, juggling is very musical. There's a tempo, there's a cadence. You can also represent juggling patterns mathematically, describing the heights of the throws and the spins and the rotations. So there, that crosstalk tends to apply to analytical minds. They like the simplicity of the patterns and also the fact that they are patterns. A lot of what I do in my own research is finding patterns, and so that component of juggling really appeals.
And you're finding patterns in your research about cancer.
Yes.
And talk more about that, what your research entails.
So my research is really aimed at finding ways to diagnose cancers earlier and to predict what they're likely to do. And so we're confronted with these huge populations of people who have cancer and people who don't, or people before they have cancer. And what we need to find are those hidden clues that we can look for and say, okay, this is what's different between someone who has cancer and somebody who doesn't.
So you just used a word or two words, hidden clues, that one would also use in magic.
Yes.
The connective tissue there.
I think both magic and science, they actually do share a lot in common. And part of what they share is curiosity. They share a skepticism for the impossible. I think as a scientist, we often tackle things that seem impossible, but then we make them possible. That's our job as scientists. A classic example might be old alchemy. People used to turn lead into gold. Well, it turns out that there was a Nobel Prize about 20 years ago for turning lead into gold. So what was originally ridiculous became scientific fact. So I think there's a lot in common between both the analytical minds. Magicians are incredibly, incredibly neurotic, very detail-oriented, very precise. Those are the same attributes that make for being a good scientist.
Talk about that precision and magic. How does that work? I mean, to someone who watches it, I'm always amazed by the precision and how I can't catch someone, quote-unquote.
Well, if you have a good magician, they shouldn't let you catch them. That's actually, there's a derogative term in magic called teaching. That's when you give away the trick while you're doing it. Mm-hmm. And the reason that you're able to do that is hours and hours and hours of methodical practice, that everything is so smooth that really people get distracted by how smooth things are, by the story. And they're not so fixated on what your hands are doing. But that only comes from moving past a point where you're even thinking about the technical details of moving your pinky a quarter of an inch, so that it's become muscle memory.
So tell me about your path in science.
Yeah.
You were in high school. You liked magic, but you said, that's not going to be my career. I'd like to pursue science.
Yeah. So I've always loved science ever since I was a kid. My mom used to take me to the academy in San Francisco to learn about all sorts of things when I was a kid. In high school, I had two truly amazing teachers. I had a computer science teacher who I took AP computer science from, learned how to program and learned about algorithms. And it was thrilling. It was amazing. And then I had this amazing biology teacher, Mrs. Sweeney, who came from Genencor and taught us how to clone things and express things and to do genetic tests. And so I loved both of those things very early on. And I had a really transformative experience. I had also always wanted to be an astronaut.
Hmm.
That was my life plan, was to be an astronaut. And
what happened?
They stopped hiring astronauts. Mm-hmm. So I needed a backup plan.
And your undergraduate degree was in?
It was in half computer science and half biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
So I always was living at that intersection between the two.
And what was your path to Stanford?
In undergrad, I was at Washington University, and I was half computer science, half biochemistry. I was really studying proteins and protein structure and how they function. And then I did my graduate work at UCLA, again, bridging computer science and biochemistry, postdoc at the Institute for Systems Biology. And that really influenced my way of thinking, that you have to think not just about the individual entities, but how they talk to each other, how they interact, that the concept of biology as a system, not just individual isolated components. I was then faculty in Los Angeles for several years at both UCLA and USC, and moved up to Stanford about 5 years ago.
And you were with the Canary Institute.
Yes.
For cancer early detection.
Yes. So there was an amazing opportunity. Really, the reason that I came up here was that they were founding this new center, the Canary Center for Cancer Early Detection.
Funded by the Canary Foundation.
Right. Funded by the Canary Foundation. And it had a very clear mission. Its goal was to find ways to diagnose cancers earlier. And it's very clear that if you diagnose cancers earlier, you can have a huge impact on the success of treatment.
So how has magic informed your science, and how has science informed your magic?
I'd say that there are a number of principles that, as a magician, you use to fool people that are, when applied to science, they in my own life, they were implicit. I didn't recognize that they were influencing the way that I do science until pretty recently. But for instance, there's a concept called assumption bias. So assumption bias is when you think you're looking at something, you will tend to see it. It's a reasonable thing to do. As humans, we need to do this all mm-hmm. the time. For instance, when you look at half a stop sign, you infer the other half of the stop sign. So And you need to do that. Otherwise, you wouldn't. If you only stopped when you saw the whole stop sign, there'd be a lot of accidents. But that same predictive power that our brains do to fill in the blanks in everyday life are also the same things that can mislead us as scientists, can make us unintentionally make assumptions that are wrong, and are also the things that make magic work.
And what do you tell, you know, what's the feedback you get from research scientists who hear that you do magic? Are they curious about it? Are they sort of, you know, do they see the connective tissue, the connection between it? Are they curious about it?
I'd say that's actually changed over the years. Mm-hmm. For many years, up until probably 3-4 years ago, I actually didn't tell anybody. I kept my magic and circus worlds completely distinct.
Why was that?
It really had to do with perception.
Not serious?
Not serious. You must not be a very good scientist. Are you taking your science seriously? Oh, are you... when people think of magicians, they think of them as deceivers and liars, when really they're storytellers.
Were you ever worried about... I assume that's why you were worried. It was that people would say... You know, magicians are creating something out of whole cloth or whatever, deceivers, as you said, and I'm a scientist, and there is a faction of this world that believes that science is deceptive.
Yeah, and, well, that's a dangerous connection. But I was absolutely worried. I was absolutely worried about my credibility as a scientist. And I was, ironically, also worried about the other direction. My credibility as a magician and... a circus performer. Strangely enough, there's a whole class of professional circus performers. That is their job. They are circus performers. And when they find out that you're spending all this time not doing circus, they don't take you as seriously as a circus performer.
In this world of alternative facts that we've heard the term recently, what do you think that those two worlds can learn from this new language?
Well, I'd say that it's actually really unfortunate that science and magic don't spend more time together. Historically, scientists and magicians were actually very close. If you go back to the 18th, 19th century, some of the best scientists were also magicians. The communities talked frequently. Science and really, magic on some level were the popularizers of science. They would give these amazing demonstrations where half of the show would be magical tricks of prestidigitation and the other half would be physics. You actually can find these playbills that say amusing physics, prestidigitation, geology, all by the same person. And so those perspectives and the openness and the creativity from the magic community really spilled over into the science. It helped people think creatively. It helped people explain science to the lay public. And I actually think that's part of the unfortunate loss in having these two communities so disparate. As scientists, we don't do a good enough job these days of communicating our science, of explaining it, of making it tangible. And the consequence of that is that breeds distrust.
Right. I mean, I just came from a workshop that I was doing with research scientists about storytelling and about narrative and about it. And I asked how many want to become storytellers or be comfortable with storytelling. And I didn't have many research scientists in this small group say that they wanted to for a lot of different reasons.
Well, that's really unfortunate because researchers are storytellers. Research, the fundamental purpose of research is to find ways to understand the world around us. And perhaps if we understand it, we can then affect it. Those are stories.
What are you hoping, you know, you're going to carry this forward. You have a presentation. You're going to be making a presentation to a large group of scientists relatively soon. What are you hoping to accomplish?
I think I'm hoping to open people's minds to the blockades that they don't even realize they have. Magic is all about perception. It's all about how you observe things. Now, there's a terrifying thought that says that in the science community, we're observing things, we're perceiving things, but the same thing that makes magic work makes our science mean that we're actually not observing what's happening. That's a terrifying thought. It means that what we claim is reality is not. So I'd like this to open people's eyes to where the holes in their perception are.
You said you used the word blockades. Tell me more about that. What do you mean?
Well, so another principle of magic. So I mentioned before assumption bias. So there's another thing called inattentional blindness. Inattentional blindness is when you're looking at an object on your left, you can't see what's happening on the right. That happens a lot. For instance, in biology, we might fixate on some particular gene as being really important. Well, and then we don't see the other gene that's three streets over that's actually doing the heavy lifting because we're so fixated on the wrong place.
How rigorous is the training as a magician, as a circus performer?
Oh, terrifically so. It's very different. I'd say that both magic and circus are really trades. And so you take a mentor, and it's a process. Mentors will interview dozens of candidates before selecting someone.
Who was your mentor?
I've had several. My very first mentor, my first serious mentor, was a guy named Dave Thorson, who was from Orange County, California, and a very accomplished magician. And I really learned a lot from him. The person who I perhaps learned the most was a guy named the Amazing Steve in Seattle. He really focused on presentation and simplicity. His point was that there are a lot of magicians who really enjoy the acrobatics of it. They enjoy the finger flicking and the coordination. But that's not what people perceive as magical. What people perceive as magical are things that are very simple, that there's not a lot of room for complicated explanations. And he really drove that point home. So in my own magic, I try and strip it down and use very simple props, very simple explanations, very few movements. And what I found is that by doing that, the magic is 10 times more magical. People aren't obsessing and they're like, oh, he's just very coordinated. They actually see something and it is astonishing to them.
How would you define magic?
Well, I'd make a distinction. So there really are two different, completely different things. So one is, I'd say, entertainment magic. And that's the sort of thing where, you know, the David Copperfields of the world. I'd say there's another type of magic entirely, which is more the natural magic of, you know, of unexplained phenomena. I actually think that entertainment magic has a very specific purpose. It's there to entertain and amuse and delight and surprise. Magic, on the other hand, of the natural world is just astonishing and amazing and beautiful on its own. There's no practice involved. It's when you
things that occur because of
things of the unexplained. Mm-hmm. And I personally see magic in all sorts of things all around me. I remember I walked out of my garage one morning and there was this leaf suspended in midair, and it was just floating there, spinning around. It was utterly amazing. Of course, when I got close enough, I saw that it was suspended on this single spider web. Mm-hmm. But for a brief moment,
mm-hmm. You believed that it was just floating in air.
Yeah,
your eyes,
and it was lovely. It was really lovely. And I think if we stop and notice, there are a lot of things that, I mean, gravity. Golly, the fact that we have a name for it doesn't mean that I have any idea how it works. It's astonishing. It is utterly astonishing. It is magical. The fact that we have a name for it doesn't take away from the fact that it is magical.
Were there similarities between the great mentors you had in magic versus the great mentors you had in research science?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think some of those traits, like I said, between being a scientist and a magician, my graduate advisor, Dr. Eisenberg, is an amazing storyteller. He has an incredible clarity of thought. When he talks, he talks in a very reserved and calm manner, but there's this undercurrent of excitement. And I'd say that the great magicians have that as well. And so when I take the lessons from both sides, lessons like really putting your heart into something and just going for it without reserve, that's critical in both science and magic. What I mentioned before about being meticulous, the attention to detail, there is no better way to ruin an experiment than by being sloppy. same thing. It is the absolute best way to ruin a magic trick.
How do you want to take this forward? And, you know, the combining the issue of magic, the practice of magic, and the research, and how do you want to push it out there?
I think I've become very cognizant that there really is a role for magic as an educational tool. I think there's also a role for understanding the principles of perception in doing good science. So in the future, I really would like to make the scientific community more aware of their perceptual blockades and use the magic as a vehicle for doing that. For example, I gave a lecture at MIT, and as part of this inattentional blindness, halfway through the show, I actually changed ties that I was wearing. And at the end of the show, I asked the entire audience, you know, 300 people, how many people noticed the fact that I had changed ties?
Wow.
Nobody.
Wow.
Now, this is I changed from a bright red tie to a bright blue tie. It wasn't a subtle alteration. And yet, they didn't notice.
Why now, didn't they notice?
They were distracted. There was a case of inattentional blindness going on, and also a case of change blindness.
That's pretty astonishing. I mean, changing a tie is sort of, you know, threading it through and doing all that sort of, it's a deliberate act.
It is. It's a whole process, and I'm sure that similar things are going on in our data. When we study these complicated systems like biology, there are all sorts of things going on.
Where is the word perform magic? Is that the word you perform magic? Where do you do that now?
So I've performed at the Magic Castle. I've done private shows at people's houses, corporate events. Everywhere from theaters to trade shows.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, Parik, it's great to talk to you, and very interesting. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about the presentation you're doing and tying it together and helping. I think one of the really important things you're doing is helping people understand the significance and the importance of storytelling in science.
It's critical. It's really critical. As a scientific community, we need to share all the amazing things we're learning with the broader community. It will, by understanding what we're doing and why we're doing it, it will help diffuse the distrust that is continuing to grow. I have to say, I find it astonishing that in the 19th century, normal people went to see shows about science in the same way that people today go see the latest Iron Man movie. People would go to have a lecture on physics. Common everyday people. That needs to be brought back, that concept of science as something that everyone can and should.
Science is fun.
Science is fun. It should be engaged with. It's amazing, but it's also approachable.
Thank you for joining me in One to One.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Good.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.